start out in a section here at the end of chapter 10, kind of dealing with government, kings and princes under the sun. Before we read the section 16 through 20 is where ultimately we're going to be reading here in just a moment. What have you noticed with regard to elections here in the United States in the last couple of years?
Very divided.
Okay. Man, wow. Yes, okay. Very divided. Pleasantly divided?
No.
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 Polarized.
Polarized, not in a good sense. No, pretty ugly. How would you describe candidates here recently? In Alabama? Or in presidential elections?
Without character. Morals.
Well, it's interesting because in Alabama, one party was saying our candidate has great character, the one who was elected has great character, as opposed to Roy Moore, who has no character. You know, that he would, you know, proposition a teenage girl. And so they would say that their candidate had great character. As a biblicist, I won't say as a Republican or a conservative, but as a biblicist, I would say he has no character. And why would I say that?
No. Base it off of the word of God. He's not
yet. You know anything about that candidate who was elected senator in Alabama?
Very talented.
He abortion up to. Up to delivery. Okay, I go, whoa. Whoa. You know, how can you? You know, again, yeah, I'm a Christian and I'm very pro-abortion. You know, you're making my head spin. So we see this in politics here in our country where you go, man, both of the candidates, you want to wash your hands. Afterwards, going, you know, I don't want to vote for either one. I don't. And do I compromise? You know, that's a whole other situation. We talked about it as we approached the last election. But I would contend the candidates reflect the people. Yeah, society. The candidates reflect the people. And so we are, in our country, reaping what we have sown. You know, we want an amoral culture and society, then that will be the leaders we elect. And, you know, no point calling it a scandal. It's just what we asked for. Here, Solomon is going to look at leadership, and he's gonna start out kind of looking at age for the leader. Would somebody read? Let's see, 16 and 17, please. Chapter 10.
16 and 17.
Yes, please. Thank you, Corbin.
Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad, and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility, and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness.
Okay, so he says that the negative is a king who is what?
Child.
Young. Youngest president in the United States?
John F. Kennedy.
No. He was the youngest elected. I had to look it up, so it's not like I had this knowledge. No. I looked it up. John F. Kennedy was the youngest elected president. Teddy Roosevelt was the youngest president because of McKinley's assassination. So he was thrust into office, kind of blew everybody's mind there. He was 42 years old. JFK was 43 at the time. Oldest elected president? Donald Trump, actually. Before Donald Trump, it was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan at 69. Ronald Reagan was 69, Donald Trump was 70. So if we look back and we look at age, we go, okay, what kind of president was Teddy Roosevelt?
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, as history looks back and goes, yeah, he's a good president. Ronald Reagan? Good president. JFK?
Smart.
Good. He was a good president. I mean, he was a good president. We go, hopefully you don't go, oh, he's a Democrat, tweet. I mean, if you were to look at the things that John F. Kennedy advocated then, he would look like a conservative today by comparison, as opposed to a Democrat. He would not even be on the Democratic ticket. They wouldn't take him. Interesting. And Donald Trump, you know, the history's out on him yet. There's much yet to be seen. So youth, we go youth in the presidency, but youth, our youngest president was 42. That's not really very young. Okay? Youngest king of Israel, Joash, at age 7. And he was a very good king as long as Jehoiada the high priest was around. And when Jehoiada the high priest went away, there went his chief counselor, and Joash went his own way, and not so good. Second youngest was Josiah at age 8, and he did well his whole life. So young, what do you think Solomon's beef is here? What's the problem? What is the problem? What are some of the risks of a young leader?
Impulsive, immature.
Frontal lobe isn't fully developed. Yeah. Making decisions.
Yeah. You know, what maturity,
wisdom.
Impulsive, yeah. Wisdom. How much wisdom does a young man have? You know, he doesn't have a whole lot of life experiences, and that doesn't mean, again, that such a one can't be wise. He doesn't have necessarily the life experiences to draw from, but as with Joash, if you have wise counselors who can assist you, you can be a great leader. You know, wisdom does come with age, and really, we know wisdom comes from the fear of the Lord. So if you have a heart, a humble heart, and you are willing to pursue after the things of God, you can be a wise man, not necessarily through your experience, but through wisdom that comes from above. God's wisdom. So... yeah, I mean, you can think of the temptations of youth, being swayed by peer pressure, being swayed by pleasure, and the like. And so Solomon, and that's typically why also we see in our country that older men and women now, more so now, older men and women are the ones who are elected and not youngsters, simply because... volatility, unproven, and the like. But he contrasts that, the young king, with the son of nobility. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility. Notice he doesn't say old. The son of nobility. Now, in our country... when we think of sons of nobility, do we think, oh, favorably, that's a great thing to be a son of nobility, or do we scoff? Mm-hmm. Why? Why do we scoff?
Part of it, I think, is jealousy, and part of it is because in today's society, it seems everybody who has money is kind of a jerk. Like, I mean, when you see, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous, that's kind of the outlook that we have.
That's
not... true.
Absolutely.
That's the stereotype that comes with it.
Absolutely. It is a commercial stereotype to really to play upon the haves and the have-nots.
I would say that I think that's part of our American culture, too. too, is we like to build these people up and then watch them crash and burn.
Yeah,
because they're not, you know, I mean, I've never been there, but I've never really seen a British person want the royal family to be torn down like we do our celebrity nobilities. You know, as American culture, we enjoy watching that. It's good TV for Americans to like watch these nobles.
The rich
and nobles. You know,
let us not
crash and burn.
Is rich and nobility equal?
No.
You know, I don't think anybody would call the Kardashians a noble family. Okay? So what is nobility? What is nobility? Happy are you when your king is the son of the nobility. What is the nobility?
Well, it could mean you could be talking genetically that you go from the line of.
Well, that's essentially what they're talking about.
And then you also have noble as in.
So, what is that nobility? Let's. What is that genetic nobility? You are born into what?
A royal family of some sort, bloodline.
Okay, it may be a royalty of some fashion. Does blood mean you are going to be a righteous man or a good king? No, you can look at the kings of Judah, who are all descended from David, and it's like Ski and the Moguls. Good king, bad king, good king, bad king, good, 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 bad, bad, bad. And it's all going downhill, unfortunately. There. So it can be a bloodline. What else do we typically associate with nobility? Okay. How are they raised?
Well.
How are they raised well?
Highly educated.
They are highly educated. And so they, and usually there's a breadth in the education of the nobility, of cultures and countries and languages and philosophies and the sciences. So really, it was almost like the first liberal arts education that wasn't available to the middle lower class, but was available to the nobility because they had the books. Somebody else say something else with regard to nobility?
Well, I have a question about it. Does the Greek or Hebrew word for that kind of steer you that direction for education?
No, not particularly.
Okay.
You know, again, you're thinking royal class. But that is what you find within the royal class, within the nobility there. You know, a noble man will be a wise ruler, typically. I mean, when you think nobleman, again, all from the same root, you think the person is going to care for the poor and not abuse the poor.
Essentially they are form of government of God's justice. You know, if they're righteous and they're in the way that they do things, if they're noble in the way that they do things, the justice should align with God, and then everything is good.
Yeah. You know, we see here, and he gives the example that they feast at the proper time, and they feast for strength, and not for drunkenness. Not just a party to get drunk. Okay, so an example, they choose a wise path there in our nobility. You know, we highlight oftentimes here American stereotypes. And I hope and pray that as we go from this place really saturated in God's word, that as we have opportunity that we can speak against these American stereotypes. You know, when people diss nobility, you go, wait a minute. You know, to counter false thinking in grace and truth is so important. You know, if we hear something counter to or contrary to God's word, that we address it. We don't just go, okay, that's okay for you. No, it's not okay. It's false. It is a false thought. It is a false idea. And so to pursue that in love, and the person can go, yeah, whatever, you know, he can go talk to the hand, you know, okay, that's fine. But still, we have that responsibility to, and what a blessing, you know, if somebody, you know, especially an unbeliever, is willing to discuss it with you. You know, and to hear perhaps that the word of truth going into body and soul and mind will take root. Verse 18 almost sounds like he's now taking a different tack, but I think we kind of see this idea of leadership continue on. Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks. Okay. What is required to keep a house? Does it take care of itself? It requires maintenance. You're either going to do it, pay for it, or watch it deteriorate. Through indolence. What a great word. Did you use that in the last year as a word? File that one away. Indolence. Dude, you are lazy. Again, the idea of inertia and not willing to work is present there. And it causes decay. Is that true in a nation? Does it require work for a nation to succeed?
Yes.
Okay. Do we want to do it?
Outsource it.
You know, whose job is it to work in our country?
Every capable body.
Do we think that, though?
No, really?
No, absolutely not.
Depends on what your definition of work is, too. Like, are you talking, like, blue-collar work? Because that's for the middle class and below, you know, is what how our society views it.
How do we work in our country? How, you know, and hopefully the leaders in our country encourage industrious behavior, industriousness, industry. Industry is a good thing. What does industry do? It creates, okay? It creates. Industriousness is labor, ideas, and the like, to ultimately keep our house, to keep the roof up, to keep everything functioning within, and it requires labor. Does it require blue-collar workers? Does it require white-collar workers? Yes. Yes, absolutely. Does it require non-workers? No, work is important. It is important. It's important in the home to keep our homes. If it's nothing more than vacuuming or cleaning the toilet, you know, or cleaning my dishes, those types of things. You don't clean your dishes, you're going to start having pets that you didn't ask for in your house. So, you know, we would expect, not only in our own home, but we would expect our kings and our princes to encourage labor as well. He kind of goes off the rails in verse 19 a little bit. Bread is made for laughter, wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Anybody want to finish that verse? Under the sun. Under the sun. Is bread made for laughter? What do you think of when you think bread is made for laughter?
Cake.
Okay. A party. You know, it's a party. Woo-hoo. Is bread made for parties?
No.
No, of course not. And we look at that and we go, of course not. Bread is Yes, it's necessary unless, you know, I'm not going to get into gluten and all that jazz. But it's necessary. The idea is it's necessary, great word, sustenance. Okay, so we go, well, bread isn't made just for laughter. And wine gladdens life, does it? Can it? Yeah. You know, oh, you know, take the edge off kind of thing. What else can it do? It can bite like a snake. I tell students when I'm teaching them to fly at night that flying at night is a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, but it's like handling a rattlesnake. You know, handling a rat. I've never done that. I wouldn't even go encourage that. But for those guys who do, they don't have a problem doing it. You know, they enjoy the rattlesnake. It's great. Until you get complacent. When you get complacent, you get bit. You get bit. And alcohol is one of those things that if you are not purposeful with it, it will bite like an adder. Wine gladdens life. Yes and no. And money answers everything.
It's true, depending on how far you want to go.
Can I buy myself a wife?
Yes.
Sure can. Can I buy myself love? No. Money can't buy me love. Yeah, yes.
I'm glad you said it because I was thinking it.
Okay, yeah. Money can money buy life? Can money stem the tide in your grandfather? No. You're not gonna stop that tidal wave, you're not. Death comes to all men. You can't. So does money buy everything? Does money answer everything? No. Can it answer a lot? Can it be a problem? Absolutely, just like all of these things. So really this verse, it's you know, he's talking about the government, and then he riffs off for a minute and he goes, under the sun, people think party, drink, enjoy, just spread money and that will provide every solution. And he is really getting to the end of his argument. And really, that was a cynical statement on his part, because he knows it's not true, and we know, reading it, it's not true. But we also see that as a pervasive idea in our culture, that these things are true. So therefore, citizen, even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. Why ought not the citizen curse the king? Why ought not the blue-collar worker curse the man? Why ought not the citizen curse the king? Why ought not the blue-collar worker curse the man?
I mean, the verse seems to say, don't do it because they're going to hear about it eventually. But I kind of think, well, maybe, but shouldn't you just not even curse them in the first place? Like, whether or not it's heard, it shouldn't be said.
Good. Okay, under the sun, again, we understand that our words, if our words come out of our face or are sent, ooh, there's that send button, don't do it, just backspace. Most powerful key on the keyboard is the backspace or the delete button, either one. Awesome. Use it often. Don't hit send. Don't hit send on your phone. Don't hit send. Don't.
Recall.
Yeah, you can't. Because when your words are out there, especially now in the technological age,
they're there forever.
Yes. They are not ever. I don't care how you scour them. I don't care what kind of a computer goober you are. Somebody else is going to be gooberier than you are and can find it.
Well, and now we have, you can take a screenshot of anything, so it doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, and what consequence to you, ultimately? Man, it could be devastating. Could end your life. Could ruin your career. Now, there are some things I will go, I don't care if it ends my life. Standing here as a teacher of the Word of God, I have to convey the truth. We're recorded. It goes out there. For me to say this is sin, it is, because that's what it says. You want to take my head off for that or throw me in prison? I can't not say that. I must say that. It is the truth. It is the truth. And I don't say that to be an arrogant jerk. I say that because I care about people not going that way. Don't go that way. That is sin. That is wrong. That is not proper thinking. We have that responsibility. But Sarah brings up a key point. I don't simply bridle my tongue to avoid punishment. As a believer, if I am cursing the king, what is amiss? Yes. Peter tells us to what with regard to the king? Honor the king. Paul says the same thing. To honor the king. To honor the king. And this is so beautiful. Because at the time that Paul and Peter were both penning that, Paul to the Thessalonians, Peter to the churches of the dispersion, Nero was the king. You're not going to get a worse guy. Okay, you probably can. But, man, he's about as bad as they come. And they say, honor the king. Honor the king, not to speak ill of the king. That doesn't mean we are just complacent sheep. We highlight the wrong that the king is doing and hold him to account for those actions and those deeds. But I don't just flippantly go out and curse the king. Tune in the news. Listen to Hollywood with regard to the president. And it doesn't matter who the president is, you're going to find somebody to speak poorly. Control your tongue. Have control over your tongue. Don't say it. He moves from here and goes into a section in chapter 11, right at the start of chapter 11, about wise stewardship under the sun. Wise stewardship under the sun. David, would you read 11, 1 through 4, please?
Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth, and if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. Through 4, you said?
Yep.
Okay. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap.
And you're going, what is she talking about? Cast your bread upon the waters. What does that mean? And I'll tell you right now, theologians differ on what it means, so we're going to be in good company here. Why would I cast my bread upon the waters? Who would do this thing?
Kids who want to feed the ducks.
Okay, to feed the ducks or the fish. Okay, to throw out, am I willing to take a loaf of bread? And what do I have to do to that loaf of bread? Do I keep it to eat it? No, I sacrifice it that I might call the fish in and catch more fish. What is in play here? This is investment. To make an investment, what is required?
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice. I have to sacrifice something. So it could be, just what's another way your bread could be cast upon the waters? Think bigger boats. What if I made a whole bunch of bread and put it on a boat and set it a sail to multiple ports? Why would I do that?
Money,
to make money. Okay, I would do that to make money. Is it risky? Yeah, what could happen to those boats? It could sink. What could happen to the bread? It could get moldy. What could happen? Maybe it isn't bought. But what if it is? Money, money, money. Yeah, very good. You guys are good. Yeah, money. The idea. So in both of those instances, you have kind of a concept of investment. There. Another possibility that they talked about was throwing seed in the marshes. If I cast my seed in the marsh, what could I have done with that seed?
Eaten it.
I could have eaten it. Again, all of these imply a sacrifice that has to be made to ultimately bring about a long-term gain. Okay, do we want to sacrifice anything?
Not often.
Not really.
Unless it's a sure positive return for us.
And when do I want that return?
Now.
Yeah, right. Blackjack. The one-armed bandit, the lottery. I want a return now.
Well, I mean, that's when you're talking, under the sun. But as Christians, I think that you should want to sacrifice things. I mean, you should be willing and sacrifice with a joyful heart. I immediately thought of tithes, but then I thought that's not really a sacrifice because God gave that to you and then tells you to give it back. So it's not really a sacrifice.
My tithe?
Tithes. You can also sacrifice your tithe. I mean.
Probably should. Yes. And that's really going to take us into verse 2. But there are two things, investment. And as believers, where is our primary investment?
Not here.
Okay. And to invest in the next life, what does it require here? Huge sacrifice. Paul counts all things as rubbish, as loss, as refuse, as dung, that he might gain Christ. Again, that is a future forward-looking thing. And, where I'm sitting as an older guy, closer to the end of the finish line, I'm seeing that more and more and going, ah, yeah. When I was younger, I'm like, no, I don't see that. Okay, investments, yeah, okay, I gotta start putting money away, yeah, okay, I understand that. But really, to understand the importance of setting my mind on things that are above, to store up treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy. So he tells us to cast our bread upon the waters, to invest. And that is a prudent, and we could talk investments, I won't go into it, but that is a prudent investment strategy. You don't put all your eggs in one basket, you spread them out. Diversity and diversifying is very important. Because if one of them goes away, if one of my ships sinks, maybe the other six will bring in, like farmers who have multiple fields all over. You know, maybe this one field gets hit by the hail and the others do not. Diversity, huge. Maybe one crop gets eaten, the other one doesn't. So very important. Give a portion to seven or to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on the earth. So this is true not only as far as our investments are concerned, but also in what Shauna was highlighting, our giving as well. Our giving. Why should we be givers? He tells us to. Okay, so that would be obedient. Okay, I'll pry open my wallet. Why more? Yes. What have we been given?
Everything.
Everything. We have been given everything. Again, we are, and this is the best thing to think of yourself as a believer. You are a steward of what? Okay, give me some examples of what you are stewards of that you really would like to possess. Because
money.
What else are you simply a steward of, and not the owner of?
Our children.
Thank you. Our children. How many parents possess with fists closed tightly their children? Do not ever want to let them go. I'm going to shelter and protect my babies. No, they're not yours. You are a steward. To be able to let them go and head out. Our time. Our church. Well, this is God's church. We are stewards. We are servants in the body of Christ. And so we are to give. I mean, we know and we understand the importance of giving to the church first as a priority, but our giving doesn't end there. Our giving need may surface within our families, our immediate families, that I need to take care of my immediate family, or I need to take care of my family within the church, or I need to take care of my neighbors, or maybe a stranger. Maybe God has gifted you and there's a particular disaster you want to help send relief to. Great. Great. Maybe with your time. I had a friend who lived down near Bowie, and when the tornado ripped through Joplin, he was one of those guys who could fix anything and do anything, and he loaded all his tools up on his big flatbed and drove up there and took like 2 weeks of vacation from his regular job just to go help out in Joplin. You know, time and sacrifice. There. So it's not necessarily just money. So we invest wisely, we give lavishly. Really because we are stewards and we ought to be wise stewards. So if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. If a tree falls to the south or to the north, and the place where the tree falls, that is where it will lie. And we go, yep, sure. What's the point of that? Who makes the tree falls where it falls? God. And the rain falls where it will. God. And we'll get to that here. A little bit more as we get to God's provision or God's sovereignty in verse 5, but we see it played out there in verse 3. What's happening in verse 4 here? He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the cloud will not reap.
Crash
Yeah. You know, there's a lion in the streets. They're frozen. There's such worry, there's such angst over, oh, what might happen? They don't ever do anything. As a believer, man, you know, this is not exhorting rashness. But it is condemning paralysis. You know, I should study through an issue. But as God moves me, boom, get out there. Act. Don't be so paralyzed that nothing happens.
In an agricultural sense, both of these inhibit action. Your observation of the wind or the clouds is either slowing down or you're stopping what you should be doing.
Yeah. Terrible.
John MacArthur wrote, "There is no virtue in wishful wondering, but there is hope for those who get busy and do their work." Yeah.
Proverbs, Proverbs, Proverbs. And Paul condemning the Thessalonians for, you know, no, the rapture hasn't happened yet. And don't sit around waiting for it. Don't wait, sit around waiting for Christ's return. Be busy. If you will not work, you will not eat. Work, work, work. Continue about the business that God has given you. You know, in verse, I'm kind of skipping ahead here, but in verse 6, you see, well, let me anchor in verse 5, because verse 6 kind of sums up the first five verses. Verse 5, I mean, what beautiful imagery. "As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child." You know, how does God put the Spirit in? When does God infuse the Spirit in the child? How does all the DNA give all the information for everything to start dividing? How does one cell become two identical cells, but then they start to diversify at some point to become bone cells and cardiac and eyeballs and retinas and earlobes and toenails, fingernails? How does the fingers growing, but oh, there's a fingernail on it now. What? And doctors, for the most part, are just going to go, "Oh, well, you know, this is..." No. They can only know so much. And then we have to step back and do what? Be in awe. I mean, think of... I started riffing on, or just writing down different responses or reactions that we should have to the work of God who makes everything. I mean, awe is one of those things. What else? What else should? What's another response? I think you said trust. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if God is sovereign, there should be trust. What's another response you should have? Or could have, in light of God's sovereign majesty over the one who knits babies together in wombs and holds the stars in place.
Thanksgiving.
Yeah. We should bubble with thanksgiving. What else?
Like a healthy fear. You know, if he could create the sun, you know, and keep us from crushing into it, he could.
Yeah. Joy. This is your God. This is your Father. This is your big brother, Jesus. And what a
desire to know him better.
Shouldn't it?
I was thinking career day.
Huh?
I was thinking career day. Oh, like at school.
Take him
guess
to work.
Guess what my dad can do.
You know, these are just seven that I wrote down. Awe, wonder, trust, worship, delight, joy, peace,
obedience.
You know, all of these things should be fostered. And it takes us really to the bottom line. We'll stop here for today. In the morning, sow your seed. Okay? Invest. In the evening, withhold not your hand. What does that mean? In the evening, withhold not your hand. In the evening, travelers would come into town. In the evening, the poor would still be begging. In the evening, withhold not your hand. Invite them into your home. Feed them. Care for them. So in the morning, go out, work, labor, invest. In the evening, care for those who need caring for. Essentially, again, you see both investments. The investment of giving and the investment of for wealth's sake. In the morning, sow your seed. At the evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, whether both alike will be good. And we don't. We never know. We never know the fruit that will come from our care of another. We don't. But God does. And God's using you. I get alerts from the Pregnancy Help Center about women who come in. And it's I don't even want to read these. This abortion-minded woman comes in and leaves and never comes back again. And you go, hopeless, hopeless. No, it's not. You never know what that brief meeting, that brief interchange that took place in the Pregnancy Help Center, you don't know what God will do with that moment. How that will bear fruit potentially and possibly in that person's life down the road. I don't know what's going to happen with the investments that I make here in this life as I look forward to my treasures in heaven. Any more than I know what's going to happen to my IRA tomorrow. We don't know these things. But God tells us to continue and do these things. And we will see next week why while we have time, we are to enjoy this life under the sun, because there is coming a season, and Sarah's grandpa and Shauna's grandmother are great examples when things are going to start to not work anymore. And that's going to carry us into chapter 12. So I'll stop right there. Just some quick takeaways on 1 and 2. Or A and B there. Understand what God says about government, please. Christian, please. And speak plainly. And understand in the second that you are a steward of everything God has given you. Be a wise steward. Invest well and be lavish in your giving. That's it. I'm out of time. Bless you.